Article 12 of the Anglo-Irish Treaty provided for a boundary commission to determine the exact delineation of a border between the new Irish Free State and Northern Ireland. After independence, it took almost 2 years for that boundary commission to actually meet. It finally convened about 100 years ago, holding its first meeting on the 6th of November 1924. The journey to this moment was long and convoluted, delayed by political manoeuvring, legal hurdles, and especially Northern Ireland's reluctance to appoint their representative to the Commission. With the stakes high and divergent opinions swirling, the Commission was tasked with a complex mandate to determine the future of territories with mixed communities, weighing the wishes of the inhabitants against economic and geographic considerations. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian Dr. Cormac Moore, who's currently putting the finishing touches on a book on this very subject. Cormac, you're very welcome back to the History Show to mark the centenary of the beginnings of the Boundary Commission. So you have the Anglo-Irish Treaty signed in December 1921. The Irish Free State is created 12 months later in 1922. Why did it take so long to get round to the Boundary Commission when it was an integral part of the treaty?
Yeah, well, it was only going to be part of the treaty if Northern Ireland opted out of the Free State, which they did do pretty much the first opportunity on 6th of December 1922. So the delay in, first of all, was the Free State weren't going to push it at that time because they were in the middle of a civil war. And it looked pretty bad if you can't control your own territory and you're asking for more territory from the north. And right, that was good justification not to have the Boundary Commission convened in. They also wanted to prepare their case. The Provisional Government set up a new body called the North Eastern Boundary Bureau in the beginning of October 1922, before the Free State was officially recognised. And this was a really impressive body in terms of the people that was involved in it, the work they did, the preparation they did. It kind of culminated in a book called The Handbook of the Ulster Question, which kind of put forward a Free State and Northern Nationalist case for inclusion of big tracts of territory and people from the north to the south. But by July 23, they were ready to look for a boundary commission and they appointed their commissioner, Owen McNeill. Now, why they appointed Owen McNeill has always been a big question since then, and it hasn't been satisfactorily answered. The person we have to blame, I suppose, is actually W.T. Cosgrave. He insisted that it had to be a member of the Executive Council. Why, I don't know, because there was only 7 members of the Executive Council at the time. They were all incredibly busy. You know, they just had finished a civil war, did so much on their plate. And to actually take someone away, you know, part-time from their job, to take on this mantle of Boundary Commissioner, you know, was a strange choice.
Was it because he was a Northern Nationalist?
So, yeah, so they had to be from Ulster as well, and they also had to be a Catholic. So there was only 2 from Ulster, himself and Ernest Bligh. He was the only Catholic, so that's why he was chosen. Actually, Kevin O'Shiel, who was the director of the Boundary Bureau, he suggested his brother, James McNeill, who's the High Commissioner in London. But Cosgrave wanted someone from the Cabinet, someone he felt close to. So even though McNeill had no background, legal background whatsoever, he was chosen as the Commissioner for the Free State.
The Northern Ireland government was in no hurry to appoint its commissioner, was it?
Or were the British government? Ireland was not the only place in turmoil, political turmoil at this stage. So was Britain. There were 4 governments, 3 elections. There were 4 colonial secretaries, 4 prime ministers this time. So 23, when the Free State pushed a button to appoint their boundary commissioner, they asked if the Duke of Devonshire, he was the colonial secretary at that time, he had replaced Churchill the previous November. They asked him, can you appoint a chairman and let's convene the boundary commission? And he suggested, why don't we have a conference instead? Let's not have a boundary commission if we don't have to. Let's have an agreement between North and South and the British government. And the Irish government, the Free State government, said, yes, actually, that, you know, we're okay with that. Like, our ultimate objective is not based on the boundary commission, which is a flawed solution anyway. We would prefer Irish unity. So we're willing to give that a go. But then there was an Irish election in August 23. That delayed this conference. And then there was the Imperial Conference in London, which had later for a further 2 months. And then there was another election in the UK in November 23, and that delayed it again. The Tories lost power and a new Labour government was formed in January 1924, a minority administration, the first Labour government in history. And the last thing they wanted to have anything to do with was the Boundary Commission, because they wanted to prove they could govern and they did not want the Irish question coming back to bite them. But it did, because it, you know, the Free State were really pressurising them to move on the Boundary Commission. So a conference did happen in February, the beginning of February 24, and the British government actually offered, it was a very poor solution from the Free State's point of view. They offered a kind of a Council of Ireland type solution, even less powers than Council of Ireland. It was only for matters like fisheries, diseases of animals, railways. It was going to be trialled for a year, and there was going to be no boundary commission whilst this kind of meetings of the both parliaments, North and South. But it wasn't based on a majority of the two parliaments. It was based on a majority of each parliament. So basically Northern Ireland could veto every piece of legislation they wanted to. So the Free State government said, no, we're not going for this.
And what were the expectations of the Free State government? Or what was the expectation, certainly, of Irish nationalists about what the Free State would get from the Boundary Commission?
They expected that probably at a minimum they would get most of Tyrone from Manna. They would definitely get Newry and a lot of South Down. They'd definitely get South Armagh. And they felt they would get Derry City as well. That was the minimum. Maximum, they'd get all of Tyrone, all of Fermanagh, huge chunks of South and East Down. They'd get Derry City, they'd get, you know, lots of South Armagh.
Which would create a northern state which would not really be viable, would it?
Yeah, I think that's a bit flawed as well, because if you look, they said that economically Northern Ireland cannot survive if they lose, say, Tyrone, Fermanagh and, you know, Newry and Derry. But Northern Ireland's economy was based in Belfast and its hinterland. It was not reliant on South and West Ulster. So it could have feasibly survived. Yeah, it would have been a tiny territory.
Well, there are smaller entities in Europe. Exactly, you know, the San Marinos of this world, for example, which would survive
and Monaco.
Perfectly. And Monaco, which would survive perfectly adequately.
Yeah, so I always felt that was a flawed argument anyway. But so it was based on this wording. So the devil was in the details of the wording of Article 12. And the Boundary Bureau, they put a lot of work into preparing for the Boundary Commission, but they don't know what they're preparing for because there's no definitive interpretation of the article. And they also have this flawed belief by Sinn Féin and a lot of Northern Nationalists that the only thing that Ulster Unionists cared about was their pocket. So ultimately they felt that if they could squeeze them on economics, as Lloyd George said during the treaty negotiations, we're going to make Belfast pay for going out of an All-Ireland Parliament. And also they had this belief that if Britain left, Ulster would come readily into Ireland. They said they really misinterpreted what the Ulster Unionists wanted. Ulster Unionists hated Dublin more than they loved the Empire. The last thing they wanted anything to do with was Dublin. And that was, no matter what punishment they would have got from England or Ireland, they would never have come into Dublin readily. Just wouldn't have happened. But most nationalists believed they would have. And they based their arguments on trying to convince them of the economic benefits of coming into United Ireland and what would happen if big chunks of territory came to the Free State. And it just wasn't going to wash with Ulster Unionists. But the problem with the preparation for a boundary commission was the wording. You were going to have a boundary based on the wishes of inhabitants as long as it's compatible with economic geographic conditions. So which is more important? That was not determined. What areas of, you know, unit was going to be decided? Was it going to be counties? Was it going to be poor law units? Was it going to be district electoral divisions? That wasn't determined. And this is all going to be decided by a three-person commission with the chairperson appointed by the British government, who was a stakeholder, even though they pretended that they were a neutral kind of a go-between, you know, trying to stop two warring factions tearing each other's heads off. They were a stakeholder. They were a very interested party, and they got to choose who the actual chairman was.
And was there an expectation that, you know, in the context of the wishes of the people, that there would be regional plebiscites?
That's what the Free State were pushing for, and they were obviously basing it on what was happening elsewhere in Europe. There was about five key boundary commissions they looked at in post-First World War Europe, and there was plebiscites in not all of them, but most of them. And that's what they pushed for. Richard Feetham, who did become the chairman in the summer of 24, he did push for plebiscites, but he was warned off by his friend who actually suggested that he be appointed, Lionel Curtis, who worked in the colonial office. He suggested not to have plebiscites. It'd be too messy because you have to bring legislation. The legislation would be extremely messy when you're talking about different areas. You know, there's going to be reams and reams of paper just to determine what areas of unit would be actually the area of the plebiscite. There could be potential violence. Don't go there. That's what Curtis suggests to Feetham. And then when the Boundary Commission is convening, one of the first decisions that Feetham makes is there's going to be no plebiscites.
Let's talk about the three men who formed the Boundary Commission. You've mentioned two of them already. Let's start with the chairman, Richard Feetham. What was his background?
Yes, yeah, so he was born in Wales from a very strong religious background. His father was an Anglican vicar in Wales. One of his brothers actually became the Anglican Archbishop of Queensland in Australia. He himself took the legal route, civil service route. So he went out to South Africa at a young age after graduating from Oxford with Lionel Curtis. The two of them were in Oxford together. And they were part of Lord Milner's kindergarten, as it was called. And this was basically a group of civil servants who were kind of reshaping the boundaries of the South African Union. And they were trying to kind of make the empire, British Empire, relevant in the 20th century to survive and grow with the new conditions they was faced with. And he, you know, rises in the ranks within South Africa. He becomes a member of the Supreme Court in South Africa in 1923 before he's appointed. Now, he wasn't the first choice. The first choice as chairman was Robert Borden, who was a former Prime Minister of Canada. And he turned it down because Ulster refused to nominate their commissioner. So he wanted nothing to do with it. Wise man, not getting involved in a very messy situation. So Feetham is appointed in June 24.
And he's supposed to be an honest broker, but he turns out really, as you suggested, to be anything but neutral.
He's not neutral, but it's not because he's deliberately biased or consciously biased, perhaps. It's because of his worldview and, you know, the people he is close to and what he believes is important. So he's never going to take the Free State side because he is an empire man. And he's not going to be promoting more independence for Ireland and a more territory going to a place that might become a republic very soon. So the inherited biases he would have had obviously informed his decisions. And that was very clear when he became the chairman.
Now, the Free State Commissioner was, as you said, Owen McNeill. This was not his finest hour.
No, so we've had obviously two incidents with Owen McNeill are considered not his finest hour. The countermanding order in 1916 and then the Boundary Commission. He really was a terrible choice. He was an honourable man, arguably too honourable for this job. This is messy politics. There was a lot of toing and froing. There was a lot of underhand activity happening, particularly in 1924 within the British system and its media. He wasn't cut out for this, essentially. McNeill, for whatever reason, decided not to inform the Free State government what was happening at all. Because they had agreed
that there would be no leaks. But he honoured it, others didn't.
But he should have still kept them somewhat abreast of how things were going to a degree. He also, like, during, if you look at all of the interviews that happened, there was about 575 witness statements were presented to the Boundary Commission. And then subsequently they met a lot of them, the representatives, to interview them, to flesh out what their statements were saying. And he hardly participated at all. He was like, some of the questions he asked were just not relevant. They were totally irrelevant to the Boundary Commission. And his obviously big mistake came in 25 when he accepts the award that Feetham draws up, which is tiny movements of territory to the south, but also movement of territory to the north.
Direction.
He accepted that award because he didn't want the unanimity to be broken, which makes no sense.
In extenuation, was he? I mean, he was still Minister for Education.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Was he spending too much time being Minister for Education and he did not have as much time to devote to the Boundary Commission as he should have?
Absolutely, yep. Yeah. And this frustrated Feetham and Boor Dillon, who was the Secretary of the Boundary Commission. They couldn't get to meet McNeill a lot of times because he had to do education estimates for budgets and all of this. And it did actually hold up the Boundary Commission coming up with its award, whereas Feetham and Fisher were full-time as Boundary Commissioners.
Now, let's get around to the elephant in the room. Joseph Fisher, who was the Northern Ireland appointee.
Yeah.
Perhaps it was his finest hour, I don't know, but tell us a little bit about him.
The Northern Ireland government were insistent they were not going to appoint a commissioner. And it showed a sloppiness of the wording of Article 12. The article said that the Northern Ireland government, the Free State government and the British government appointed chairman, the three governments would appoint their commissioners. It didn't say what would happen if one of them didn't appoint their commissioner. So Northern Ireland said, we're not going to appoint a commissioner and therefore the Boundary Commission can't meet. So the British government, Ramsay MacDonald's British government, decides we can't make this decision ourselves. We need to get legal help. So he invites the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council to rule what happens if Northern Ireland does not appoint its commissioner. And they get judges from all over the empire. One of them, Knox, he's the Chief Justice of Australia. He takes a month to get to England to convene. There's a further delay, which frustrates the Free State government. And they decide that they rule that basically the Boundary Commission can't meet. So fresh legislation will have to be brought in. So the Free State government and the British government, they agree simultaneous legislation to allow the British government to appoint the actual Northern Ireland commissioner. So this is late summer 24. And Ramsay MacDonald approaches Edward Carson. And Edward Carson is interested. He said he'll do it for Ulster's interests. But the Northern Cabinet have a meeting and they go, you know, he would be good, but this could be very painful for him. Imagine if we have to give up Newry. Newry loyalists will never forgive Edward Carson. There's already a lot of sore loyalists from Donegal, Cavan and Monaghan. And then they decide, look, it's too messy if we get Carson. So they go for Joseph R. Fisher, who had previously written quite a bit to Craig about, we should go for Donegal, actually. We should go for North Monaghan. get rid of Afghanistan areas like Cross Maglen and South Armagh. This boundary commission could be a good thing. You know, it's not that we should, you know, not give an inch. We should look to get good territory that suits us and get rid of bad territory and bad people from the north. And even though Ramsay MacDonald was meant to have appointed a commissioner himself, he was lobbying and talking to Craig and getting his advice on who the commissioner would be on their hand. And ultimately, he goes for Joseph R. Fisher, who was the oldest. He was about 70. He had been editor of the Northern Whig newspaper, a very staunch, loyalist newspaper. And he was the last one appointed in late October 24. And that allowed for the commission to meet.
Now, Fisher was as leaky as a sieve. And in 1925, after the Boundary Commission finishes its work, the details of their controversial report were leaked. I presume Fisher was at least partly responsible for that, if not completely responsible for that. This caused uproar, didn't it?
Yes. So, first of all, he told Wilfred Spender, who was the Secretary of the Northern Ireland Cabinet, that you need to feed me information and I'll feed you information. You know, because I want to make sure that we have as strong a case against the Free State as possible. Then when the Boundary Commission convened the first meeting, they said, everything's confidential. You cannot talk to anyone unless it comes through the Secretary of the Boundary Commission that goes out to the press. And they all agreed to that. And Feetham and MacNeill stick to that rigorously. Fisher doesn't. He literally, November, December, he's telling the current, at the time, Northern Whig editor, Robert Lynn, what was happening with the commission. And then he develops this kind of the writing relationship with Florence Reid. She was wife of David Reid, who was an Ulster Unionist MP. And throughout 25, he is literally writing her letters telling everything that's happening. And there was no doubt about it, but she was filtering that through to the Ulster Unionist ranks. And you can notice the shift in Ulster Unionism. They don't worry from the summer of 25 because they know what's happening. They know that this is going to be, if there is going to be loss of territory, it's going to be very small. They're actually going to gain territory as well. So they're all quite relaxed, whereas the Free State are living in a, you know, willful ignorance of what's going to happen, and they're preparing for huge parts of Northern Ireland to come to the south without knowing what's going to happen. Whereas Fisher has been feeding Florence Reid all of the information to Ulster Unionists.
So W.T. Cosgrave basically has to indulge in a damage limitation exercise, doesn't he?
So the Morning Post produce a map, basically a recommendation of what the war is going to be. And a lot of newspapers were actually given their own kind of suggestions and what a border was going to be, what was going to be going to the Free State, if anything was going to go to Northern Ireland. But the Morning Post one was, you know, quite accurate, not fully accurate, but pretty much on the money. So when the Free State find this out and the Northern Nationalists find this out, they go mad. Like, they're absolutely flabbergasted that they're going to gain so little territory and actually give up some really good territory in East Donegal and North Monaghan. So MacNeill resigns from the commission, but he never tells his cabinet colleagues that he actually had agreed to this award, had signed it in mid-October. They finally find this out a few weeks later when Fisher and Feetham come out saying, why did he resign? MacNeill resigned. He agreed with us. They actually were surprised he resigned. So then he has to resign from the cabinet as well. He makes things really difficult for the Free State government because whatever chance they had of winning the PR battle was over because MacNeill had agreed to sign this award. So literally Cosgrave comes begging, basically, look, we can't have this award. The Republicans have got back in. De Valera will be, you know, into power very soon. You know, we have to scrap this award. You know, don't publish this report. Keep the border as it is, but give us something in return.
And when was the report published, or when did it emerge into the light of day eventually?
So the National Archives in Kew gave access in 1968.
So it took that long.
The Geoffrey Hand was pretty much the first person who happened to be a distant relative of O. MacNeill. He actually published a book on the report and a very good introduction. And then he did a great essay a few years later on MacNeill's role as commissioner. It's still very relevant to this day, even though it's well over 50 years ago. So he published his book in late 69, early 70, and it comes out, the full report.
So all of this was happening 100 years ago. It's a murky and complex story. We're very glad to hear that you've just about finished tying up all the strands of the story for your upcoming book. My guest is Dr. Cormac Moore. Many thanks for joining us on the programme this evening.
Thank you, Miles.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.